This is Wade Rathke, and you're listening to Wade's World, a Voice of the People program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Greenville, Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay, points north and south, east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at kabf.org and acornradio.org. A podcast will be available to the show on these websites and at affiliatedmediamovement.org. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. Today we're talking to Matt Danaher, who's a campaign lead for Etu, and we're in Auckland, New Zealand. Matt, welcome to Wade's World.
Kia ora, Wade. Thanks for having me.
Okay. And kia ora, I now know, means hello in Maori, because we were been here for a week or so. Matt, we had a great event last night at the Auckland Trades Hall that you put together. It was great to meet all the brothers and sisters, or a lot of them anyway, from around the labor movement here on the North Island. But give us a perspective, because obviously a lot of people are listening to this in the UK and the US. North Island, South Island, what is the labor movement like here in New Zealand?
Well,
big question. Take it away.
Where do we start? Yeah. And also, what do we compare it with? So the New Zealand labor movement, starting from the beginning, kind of was very heavily British and Australian influenced, which, given the history of mass migration here from Britain, is probably not surprising. And it's kind of been, had a long history, and it's led to the strength of the labour movement in New Zealand historically, led to a country that had compulsory unionism right up to the late 80s, which is quite late compared to most English-speaking countries. And what that meant was, if you had paid work and you were employed by someone, you pretty much had to be in a trade union. And that trade union...
That's a world gone by, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that trade union had the right to go and negotiate on your behalf after consulting you on what you wanted with the employers for agreements that would set wages and other terms and conditions across entire industries. So all hotel workers or all hospitality workers.
What we call sectoral bargaining.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, that was a really big thing here. And what it meant was, on the other hand, labour laws were not necessarily that protective compared to, say, Western Europe or the UK or even Australia.
Because they assumed the union would take care of business.
Absolutely. That all came to an end when the national government, which that's a government by the National Party, who are sister party of the Conservative Party in the UK and kind of equivalent to the Republicans, they introduced some major reforms to employment law, which basically ended compulsory trade unionism and also gave employers the opportunity to put all their workers onto individual employment agreements rather than collective employment agreements. And it basically decimated the trade union movement here in New Zealand.
And what year was that, Matt?
So that was in the early 90s.
So relatively recently, within the last 25, 30 years.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And we're still feeling the effects of that today. On the one hand, there is some feeling among some older workers, older Pākehā workers, that's older white workers, that trade unions were too powerful and abused their compulsory unionism to kind of maybe not always look after their workers as best they could have, and to use some of their resources in kind of what they saw as political campaigning that they didn't necessarily feel spoke for them. On the other hand, The other side of that coin, of course, is that the smashing of compulsory unionism in an aggressive and anti-worker way by a government that was extremely pro-business has significantly weakened the ability of workers to look after themselves. the bargain and organize for themselves.
So when you say compulsory unionism, they were covered by a union, but were they also paying dues?
Or? Yeah, so they had to pay.
Okay, so there was also a, what we call a closed shop in the U.S. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm guessing that from what you said, that once they ended this compulsory unionism, labor law was then weak in terms of protections outside of a union, which made the job of unions doubly hard. One, they're weaker in terms of finances and members, and don't have a law that sets the bottom margins.
Yes, absolutely. And the other side of that was that...
Talk about going from heaven to hell, huh?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
And that compounded issues that had been caused previously by the Labour government at the time, which was, you know, the party owned by the trade unions to some extent, actually introducing a huge number of measures to basically privatise the entire economy and open the market to imports in a major kind of very early stages attempt at neoliberalism. And, you know, in the Organiser movie, actually, interestingly, there's some reference to Bill Clinton and his commitment, which obviously a lot of people, your listeners will be aware of Bill Clinton, especially from Arkansas, you know, his commitment to neoliberalism. Well, actually, the Labour government here were committed first, and in fact, Bill Clinton and others learnt from the experience in New Zealand to make those changes. And
because before, I think you mentioned to me last night, which I hadn't realized, that there were a number of protected industries for quite a long time here, from refrigerator manufacturing to even automobile manufacturing.
Yeah, so basically, imports were either banned or had extremely high tariffs on them, and it meant that, you know, workers...
Sort of like India.
Yeah, well, and, you know, like Britain used to be in the old, you know, back by before the war, you know, much of the world was, I guess. Yeah, if you were a Kiwi and you wanted to buy a pair of shoes, you might have to save up. They were expensive. You might have to save up for a couple of weeks to get them. They weren't cheap imports from developing countries. They would be made by well-paid, unionised Kiwi workers.
Uh-huh.
So you'd have reasonable money yourself to be able to afford to spend on that sort of stuff. But, as I say, you might have to save up a couple of weeks' wages still. You would have limited choice because it's a small country. You know, we're talking about less than 5 million people even now. At a time, it was nearer 3. And, you know, you had one brand of washing machines, one brand of fridge freezers. They were all made by well-paid workers. Every house could afford them. There was what people talk about, the Kiwi dream, which is, you know, the idea of owning a house with an acre.
Okay.
You own a house with an acre of land, and maybe a good vegetable garden on it, and being able to fit out your house with everything you need, and only one member of the family have to be able to work, and be able to raise a couple of kids. And that was certainly doable. People had decent lives. And on top of that, some products, some locally produced products like milk, was heavily subsidized. So you could buy, you know, a bottle of milk, a pint of milk for like a cent or 2 cents, you know, even in the 80s. So there was this kind of environment. But the government at the time took advantage of growing consumerist demand to say, hey, look, hang on a minute.
I'm looking at TV. I see X, Y, and Z. Yeah,
exactly.
How come I can't get some of that stuff?
Okay. Exactly. You can have a whole range of consumer goods at lower prices that are made in the Asian markets in particular, which are a lot closer to New Zealand, rather than paying for all this stuff that's either manufactured locally or imported from very specific countries and then with a high tariff on it. So they basically did away with all of this kind of thing, introduced a rampant market economy. Other things they did were reduce regulations for building houses, for instance. So all of us now live in cold, damp houses to some extent, even those of us that are, you know, in reasonably good jobs. Finding locally produced products that are made by unionised workers is very difficult. And it's very difficult for workers to argue for higher wages because it's very easy for the companies to threaten to close down factories and move them overseas, which they do on a regular basis.
We're talking to Matt Danaher's campaign organizer for E2. E2, I believe, is the largest private sector union here in New Zealand. And we're talking about the challenges over the last several decades. Is the picture any better now, Matt?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that, because yes, it.
Because we don't want to depress people. No, it sounds like we went from heaven to hell. Where are we now? In between.
We're on our way back.
We're on our way back.
Yeah, over the last couple of years, there's been some significant wins not just by the labour movement. It has to be said that some of our most significant changes have been brought about by the building of community organisations and. In a country which historically has not had a particularly active civil society, we've started to see a huge number of people actually get involved in their community and trying to improve their community. And one of the key campaigns that's been behind that is the living wage movement. Now, I know a lot of your listeners will be familiar with different living wage campaigns and movements around the world. Here in New Zealand, it's heavily influenced by the UK living wage model, and it's basically the New Zealand living wage at the moment is just about to go up. Actually, from the 1st of September this year, it will be $20.55. That's New Zealand dollars, of course, $20.55 per hour. And what we say is that should be the lowest anyone is paid. It's not
compulsory. And that's a mandatory.
It's the floor, but it's a moral floor. We've built a living wage movement that brings together trade unions, community groups, and faith groups. Essentially, the churches in particular have been heavily involved in the campaign for a living wage. And what we realised was that we've got all these low wage workers, and particularly in my union, we represent. Cleaners, contract cleaners, security guards, catering workers, people who work for big multinationals quite often, that will be often the same multinationals you find in the US or UK, and which are contracted to provide security, cleaning, catering, whatever, to other companies. And what we realised was that they're operating in a marketplace where we can go and bargain in those, and some of them are very well organised, and we can go and negotiate and bargain and get reasonable wage deals for union members, but they'll then go to their clients and say, hey, our margin's been reduced, so we want to whack up our fees to pay these extra bills, and the client will say, well, now you're okay then, I'm going to go and move to this other company where the union aren't organised and can't organise, and they're paying their workers minimum wage, so that makes things a lot cheaper for us. We're just going to go with that.
Is there a minimum wage in New Zealand?
So there is a minimum wage in New Zealand, yes. That's currently $16.50 per hour.
Yeah, I thought that I'd seen something like that on the web. So $20 New Zealand in September as the set living wage would be somewhere around $16 or $17 US, I think.
Yeah.
Which is a little bit better than the $15 that many unions and community groups are campaigning about in the U.S., and a little bit less than what there is in Canada. So it's all, you know, these are campaigns that are going on many places around the world. But the minimum at $16.50 is probably closer to $12, I would guess, in the U.S., which is still $7.50 an hour is the federal minimum wage in the U.S., so that's still pretty much a honking improvement. So we are talking about that. And I noticed even on the E2 website, it talks about both community and work together, which is the slogan for the union. So that's obviously a huge development in terms of community labor coalitions. We talk about that a lot on Wage World, as all of you who are listening know. Now, has the climate for organizing improved as well?
It has, and that's partly been because of the success of the living wage movement. So we've managed to get over 100 companies in New Zealand over just a few years to agree to pay the living wage to all directly employed and contracted workers, which gives them living wage accreditation, and which they can use to market themselves as being an ethical company. And that ranges from very small businesses to big businesses like Vector, who are one of our major energy companies. And what that's done is that's really triggered a resurgence of... I mean, there'd always been other things going on, and it's important as well not to ignore the Māori sphere, of organising as well, where there's been successful community movements built certainly since the 70s that have seen massive, massive changes in the conditions for Maori people living in New Zealand. I mean, this is a colonial society.
And Maoris, as most people may or may not know, are the native peoples of New Zealand, about 15% of the overall national population. Probably more significantly in the north, even in the south, but I'm not sure if that's true. So that's what we're talking about here. That's the native.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, often when people come to New Zealand, they'll speak to people like me who are actually British. And that story sometimes gets left out as far as foreign people are concerned. So I think it's important to acknowledge that, and that some of the victories they've had did kind of make it easier for the rest of us.
Yep, they led the way in some areas.
Yeah, and obviously they you know, their organisations play a key role, and they are, as individuals, they play a key role in the campaigns I'm talking about, and in my own trade union as well.
I noticed there were some significant Maori strikes that were mentioned on your website, or job actions, maybe it was, I'm not sure.
I'm not sure what the percentage of our membership union membership is, but historically Maori and Pacific Island workers have been more loyal and engaged in the trade union movement and then obviously that gives us a link into community organisations and so on as well, and I'd really like to find space to just mention as well that my union and most other trade unions in New Zealand are what we call bicultural organisations, and we recognise our obligations as organisations under what is called Te Tiriti, which is the Treaty of Waitangi, basically, which is far too long and involved a story to go into.
We were lucky enough to go to the museum and the description, which was somewhat sanitized in terms of, I'm sure, the real history. But the treaty originally promised some things that we're probably still working to see if they can be achieved.
Yeah. Long story short, the British and many of the Maori chiefs came together to draw up a treaty about how the two cultures were going to interact on the islands of Aotearoa, New Zealand, which Aotearoa is the Maori name for this country. And the one version was written in English that was signed by people, and another version was translated into Te Reo Māori, the local language. And shall we say, some important phrases and words were slightly different. So basically, Māori chiefs and the British were signing two different documents, which led to the British being able to confiscate huge tracts of land for their own profit and use, and turn the indigenous people into squatters in their own country in many ways. Since the 1970s, there's been a whole series of big settlements that have led to a significant sea change in how the country operates. And there's still a long way to go, don't get me wrong. Maori and Pacific workers are massively overrepresented among lower paid workers, massively overrepresented in prison populations and living in poorer parts of the country. But
no part of this story would be a surprise to American listeners, certainly.
No, of course. And but it's also important.
Or Canadian, for that matter.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd say our kind of experience here is probably a bit more like Canada than it is the US. From what I understand of the Canadian situation. But we've seen some big changes. They are a significant percentage of the population as well, and it's worth noting that that's why we're having community successes. It's because of the successes they had. And we owe our current successes to that and to the work they're still playing now in doing that. And we now live in a country where there's 7 political parties in the country's parliament. The leaders or co-leaders of 6 of those parties are Māori. And in the current government cabinet, the ministers, there's a significant percentage of them are Māori as well. So we are, and there's some big Māori-owned corporations and trusts and so on that operate many businesses worth hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. So there's all sorts of things like that happening, and I think New Zealand's right to be kind of proud of the progress that's been made, although...
Well, even when we talk about the name of your union, you might want to explain it too. Is not originally when I said, "Well, is it TU?" You think, "Oh, it might be trade union," but that's not at all what it is, and it's a Maori term as well. Is it
not? So it means stand up or stand tall, and we chose our name, we chose that for our name very deliberately, because every single child in New Zealand knows the word, because when a teacher walks into a classroom, etu. The first thing they say is, etu, stand up.
Okay.
And all the kids stand up. So everyone knows what it means. And it also was important for us to have a te reo name to show our commitment as well.
And this came about when you merged, when the union was merged together, or is that a more recent rebranding?
That was a result of the merger. So Etu was a result of a merger of the predominantly female-dominated service and food workers union and the more male-dominated engineering, plumbing, manufacturing union that brought everyone together, from miners to electricians to building workers and so on. So
flight attendants.
The flight attendants union, yes.
My daughter wore a E2 pin that she was given by Savage yesterday to see if she could get a better seat tonight.
Did it work?
We'll see. She's going to have to report.
Yeah.
She wasn't sure where to put it to make the connection, but she was working it.
If you fly on an Air New Zealand flight, then you will guarantee you will meet some of our union members, because they're extremely strong in that sector.
We're talking to Matt Danaher, who's a senior campaign organizer for Etu, and that brings me to a question. So what's the situation now? Unionism is not compulsory, which means it's what we call an open shop.
Mm-hmm.
People can voluntarily pay dues. Is there payroll deduction, or is there not payroll deduction? Or
so the vast majority of members of my union would pay through payroll deduction. And interestingly, and a difference between here and the UK on one hand and the US on another hand, is that when we go into a collectively bargain, we either only collectively bargain on behalf of our union members, and the employer is not allowed to pass on what we bargain to people who don't join the union, and they're employed on individual employment agreements. So that's one important difference.
It's a very interesting problem. Yeah. Okay.
So it makes it.
So there's not exclusive representation, but neither is there free riders.
No, or we will agree that they can pass it on, because it makes it easier for the employer's payroll and HR department to deal with people on the same terms and conditions.
And potentially for you recruit members.
But non-members get charged a bargaining fee, which happens to be exactly the same as the union fee. And if they just pay the bargaining fee, they still don't get representation with individual issues, but they will be entitled to.
And they don't get to vote on union elections collective agreement.
They don't participate in the union, but they still pay us fees.
And obviously big news in the United States is the Supreme Court decision in Janus, which eliminated the ability to have what are called agency fees, or what you're calling bargaining fees, for public employees. And the next battle from the right is to try to eliminate those for private sector workers as well in some states. And obviously 28 states already do not allow union shop, but in the U.S. it has to be a different level. It's a lower fee than a membership dues is, because it has to eliminate politics and other things that are not exclusively bargaining. But that's not the situation in New Zealand, from what you're saying.
We negotiate with the employer over what the bargaining fee will be, and we always suggest it's the same as union fees. And we don't.
If the employer agrees, then you have it.
Yeah. We don't always win the argument. Sometimes it'll be slightly less, but normally it's the same.
And are you required to represent everyone in the bargaining unit, or just your members?
No, only our members.
And if you extend the benefits to non-members, are you required to represent them on grievances?
No. Nope. So even if they're paying the bargaining fee, we don't represent them.
Okay. Well, now I know what I'm going to do if I'm ever an organizer for unions in New Zealand. I don't know if this is helping out the listeners, but okay. So that's an interesting thing that Matt's telling us. So what are the big organizing projects? Are there big projects E2 or others are involved in now? Any particular sectors? I mean, clearly we talk a lot about precarious workers on Wage World, which is tends to be an unorganized section. You
yes.
and I talked about that when you were still at Unison, the union in the UK.
Yeah, absolutely. So we elected a new government, very much supported by the unions, in late last year. It's a coalition government, and it's a coalition of the Labour Party, who are back on side, who we like again now. The Green Party.
A longer story for another interview, I'm sure.
The Green Party and another party called New Zealand First. who are kind of a populist kind of party that you can't. Foreigners try and compare them to.
They say, "Oh my God, America first is Trump." No, but that's not what we're talking about. New Zealand first.
Some people would like to compare the leader of New Zealand first to Trump, but that's inaccurate in my opinion.
Good.
But they do occasionally say some things that, you know, we wouldn't like. But anyway, there's a coalition that are generally a lot more positive. This is after 9 years of a hostile right-wing government that have been extremely anti-worker and have been really into increasing casualisation and vulnerability and all the rest of it for workers so that bosses can get away with whatever they want. What we're seeing now is some major projects that have been triggered by the election of a government that we asked to make several commitments. One of those commitments was around living wage that I talked about earlier. So the current government are committed to, and we are holding them to account on that, using what some of your listeners will be familiar with in terms of public assemblies, where we call them to come and give us progress updates on where they are at and delivering their promises that they made to big public assemblies of people that we mobilised that would want to vote, that might vote for them. And one of the commitments we asked for was around the living wage, and that is to deliver the living wage to directly employed and contracted workers in what's called the core government services. So that is education, police, defence forces.
Public sector is what
broadly public sector, but excluding some bits of it. But the majority of the public sector.
Which are not necessarily workers that E2 represents.
We represent the contracted workers in the public
sector. Oh, the contract, that's right.
Yeah, okay. So a lot of our members will be benefiting from
sure.
it. Now, they've already started giving it to directly employed workers, and the promise was that it would go out to all contracted workers by the next election, which is September 2020.
And that would be mandatory or voluntary?
Well, they're the employer. So they'll be paying it, and they'll be paying their... And this comes back to that race to the bottom issue that I've already mentioned.
Right.
They'll be paying it to the... they'll be paying the contractors enough to in their contracts to pass that on to the workers. And it's the union's job to make sure it genuinely is passed on and in the correct way. And that contractors don't try and claw anything back or cut costs anywhere else to kind of...
But how can the union supervise that unless those are unionized workers?
We need to get out there and unionize them.
So that's the opportunity would be to try to say,
yeah,
this is a wage possible. If you have a union, you can guarantee it. If not, they could probably get away with it until somebody finds out differently.
Yeah, there'd be nothing to stop. We've already seen some evidence of employers elsewhere trying it on and the union catching them and making sure that it does happen as it should. So that's one massive victory that we do see them following through on, as long as we keep up the pressure and we do keep organising and recruiting our members, and we always make sure that it's our leaders, the workers themselves, that are going and speaking to the politicians and speaking to the public and getting their stories out there about the impact of life on low wages, and then those that we've already got the living wage, who have already got the living wage, talking about the difference it's made. And it's been a huge thing, and it's had a knock-on effect. Just like the Maori struggles had a knock-on effect on a whole range of things, this is having a knock-on effect.
So, and I'm betting your job as a campaign organizer puts you right in the middle of this mess.
Oh, it does. And also, we always said that if we got the government elected that we wanted, we'd all be working a lot harder. Our job wouldn't get easier. It would actually get harder because we need to take advantage
of
this.
And that prediction has come true.
Yes. and the thing about New Zealand that's particularly annoying is parliamentary terms are only 3 years. So, you know, there's no guarantee our government will get re-elected after the 3 years are up. So we've got to try and get as much as we can in this 3 years.
Candles burning.
Really make hay. Yeah.
Matt, we're talking to Matt Danaher, who's a campaign organizer for E2, the largest private sector union in New Zealand. This has been fascinating. Matt, we could be talking for hours, but our time is running close to the end. Mm. Is there a website, or if people have other questions about what's happening in New Zealand or the Living Wage Campaign or what you're doing, is there a way to get a hold of you or others here?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can go to the ETU website, which is etu.nz. So that's ETU.nz.
And SNZ for you Americans. Now, come on.
Sorry, yeah. and you'll see our contact email address on there. Feel free to flick an email, send an email to that address, and say you want to speak to me. My name's Matt. I'm the only Matt in the organisation at the moment. So if you do that, they'll pass it on to me, and I'll be more than happy to get back to you.
Matt, thanks so much for everything. It was great last night, and it's been a huge experience to be in New Zealand. This has been Wade's World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. As the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week, when we'll have another guest, this is Wade Rathke from Wade's World.